work in progress, but it's nearly finished. So I will try and put together a couple of speculations for you. And the subject of dark forces, or what we call dark forces, are usually sort of new particles in the GeV scale range that possibly connecting the dark matter particles that are heavy with the Stern model. So this gained some prominence in the last couple of years because of the unusual signatures in the cosmic rays, and much research was done along these directions. And we just were interested whether any of this GeV scale relics, should they be long-lived, have an impact on early stages of particle cosmology or nuclear reactions, in particular during the Big Bang nuclear synthesis. And we found that, interestingly enough, the decaying GeV scale particles, should they have their lifetimes in that range, they actually have a potential of suppressing the primordial lithium abundance by a factor of three, which is very interesting, provided that right now there are tensions between what people observe as the Spitz plateau and what the VBM is predicting. So I've just spent the next 10 minutes on reviewing this idea of dark forces, basically. So we all, of course, think that new physics should be sitting at the weak scale and so on, and the LHC will discover it. But there is, so you need a high energy to go to probe short distance physics. But in principle, there is an alternative direction. There could be particles that are very weakly coupled, and to access these sectors, you need very much luminosity rather than high energy. And the dark forces or particles in a sort of accessible energy scale at the GeV is pretty much discussed in recent years in connection with this luminosity frontier ideas. Much of it, as I said, was instigated by speculations that WIMP signal may manifest itself in the Pamela positron anomaly and the F sort of harder than expected lepton spectrum at Fermi. And I'll go through this idea in detail. And I should also say that the idea for dark forces also kind of find its nice theoretical kind of construct in the most minimal models of extra U1 gauge fields that you can connect to the Stern model via the kinetic mixing. And so much of the sort of activity in dark particle, dark matter physics in the last 2 years were associated with the models that I call secluded models, where you have heavier particles annihilating into lighter mediators and the later decay to the Stern model. So once you start playing with this very simple kinematics, then several interesting new things can happen. If you have this two-stage annihilation process, then first you annihilate to relatively light particles, and you can cut out the heavy products in the decay. For example, if you have two neutralinos that annihilate to two Ws or ZZ, then you have a lot of antiprotons potentially appearing at the final state of hadronization, But if you have light particles at the receiving end that later decay to pions or muons, you don't have any antiprotons, but you have a lot of leptons in the final state. And moreover, if you have relatively light particles interacting with the WIMP particles, you can have the effects of attraction between particle and antiparticle, which enhances the annihilation cross-section. And that's, interestingly enough, can fit Pamela, or can tie the WIMP idea to Pamela's signal without much difficulty. In particular, some time ago, Risa and I showed that if you have relatively light mediators, you can have this process of dark matter particle encountering dark matter particle, forming a bound state, which later on, well, immediately annihilates. But the cross-section for annihilation, besides this Sommerfeld alpha over V factor, has a large numerical factor, 20, and that is enough to give a factor of, have spare slides, sorry. And that's enough to fit the Pamela signal with a sort of sub-GV mediators and in a wide range of dark matter masses. So the examples of the models that do that is indeed extra U1 field coupled to the hypercharge strength via some kinetically mixed parameter, and this kappa is the mixing angle. Plus, there may be some Higgs fields in this dark sector, and we think of the new sector being relatively light, and GEV is set by the kind of characteristic momentum of the WIMP particles in the galaxy. And that's where the GEV comes in. So the interesting part of the story that in this very, very simple model, there are, depending on how the mass of the Higgs and the vector mass relate to each other, there are some, kinematic accidents that can happen. And in particular, if you place the mass of the Higgs lighter than the mass of the vector, it will be accidentally long-lived, and it can live thousands of seconds, a year, and so on, depending on the size of the coupling. But even for the mixing on the order of 10 to minus 5, this particle can live about 1,000 seconds. And so if something survives for 1,000 seconds, you should immediately ask yourselves what can happen cosmologically with it during the Big Bang nuclear synthesis. So now I'll review the Big Bang nuclear synthesis very briefly for you. So this is a very well understood epoch in the evolution of the universe when initially you have a certain number of neutrons and protons in equal numbers at high temperatures. As the temperature starts dropping, the neutrons that are more massive become less and less abundant, and this process would continue along the equilibrium curve if the weak interactions that convert neutrons to protons were infinitely fast. But that sort of stops at around 1 MeV at temperatures where these processes can no longer catch up with the Hubble rate, and the neutron to proton freeze number density freezes out to 1/6 and being diminished further to 1/7 due to the residual decays. The onset of nuclear synthesis is delayed by the shallow binding energy of deuterium, and at temperatures around 100 keV, this is just below. This is finally over. The universe is cool enough so that the photons can no longer dissociate deuterium, and right here reactions happen, and in particular this error indicates the uptake of protons, and that's the only sort of place where the proton density is diminished. And at the same time, you can see that the number density of neutrons drops very much, quite dramatically, and that's very similar to what you have in standard recombination physics, where the number of electrons drops very, very quickly. So what's interesting, of course, here we all know that helium-4 sort of freezes out to form roughly a quarter of mass of all baryons. But what's also interesting, there are trace elements like deuterium and beryllium-7, lithium-7. Beryllium-7 is unstable later on when it receives its first electron. It eats it immediately and becomes lithium-7. Observationally, people know how to determine helium-4 over hydrogen, sort of deuterium, and there are observations of lithium-7. I should also mention that due to some special reasons of nuclear physics, lithium-6 is very much suppressed. So for a long time before sort of the CMB came into a scene big time in the 90s and to year 2000, in this past decade, this was the only game in town. So you would look at helium-4 abundance, determine eta, or deuterium abundance, determine eta baryon, plug it into lithium and see whether it's consistent or not. So since WMAP determination of eta baryon, or number of baryons relative to the number of photons, all this game is over, and you can just simply give predictions for various elements. And just before I do that, I'll just mention that particle physics can also, it's quite clear how particle physics can interfere into this picture, right? We all know that if there are some new degrees of freedom pushing the universe apart at the time of the BBN, you can have an enhanced production of helium-4 just because the freeze-out would happen earlier and you'll preserve more neutrons that find their way into helium-4. You can have decays of primordial particles that would split some of the helium-4 into deuterium, and that could be observable. Or you could have some completely crazy scenarios where you have charged particles, unstable charged particles that exist during the BBN for some time and get into the bound states with nuclei and catalyze the reactions. So there are different ways particle physics can affect the outcome, and today I'm going to be interested in the decaying particles. So before I go to the calculations that we did, I'd just like to mention the following. So these are the theoretical paper written soon after the first WMAP results came, and it shows the following. So here is the prediction of deuterium abundance with the WMAP input. And here are the observations. You can see that deuterium is roughly consistent, but one should be weary of large scattering the deuterium data points, and which might be a sign of overall depletion. Nobody knows. And with lithium, the situation is even more dramatic because you have a prediction which is very much higher than the what's is referred to as a speed plateau, the plateau of lithium with metallicity that was observed since early 80s. Of course, nobody knows whether, right now everyone is saying that nobody knows whether this is primordial or not. Throughout the 90s, this was really believed to be a primordial value for lithium-7, so now the people's faith in this got shaken quite a bit. So the lithium problem is this factor of 4 to 5 discrepancy between lithium observed along the speed plateau and the what's predicted. It's over-predicted. And unlike other elements, trace elements like beryllium 9 is not primordial and shows very strong correlation with metallicity here. There are some speculations that maybe there is a primordial abundance of lithium 6, but this is not confirmed by all groups. So I just say a few words what's happening with lithium 7. How it gets generated is very, very simple story. It's the problem comes from the overproduction of beryllium 7. There is one reaction in which is very well measured, well enough measured, and there are two reactions out. So there is beryllium 7 being converted by neutrons to lithium 7, which is fragile at the temperatures of 40 kV and being burned to two alphas. So if you have a new physics mechanism that enhances the population of neutrons from, say, 10 to minus 6 to 10 to minus 5 at the 40 kV, you will suppress beryllium 7 and you would deplete an overall abundance of lithium 7. So I should also say that many of these reactions that participate into this lithium chain are actually quite well known from the solar physics and from the solar neutrino problem. So there are various ways the lithium 7 can be resolved. There are astrophysical ideas how that can happen due to the diffusional mixing in the stars. But this is yet not to be, I mean, it might be the answer, but there's no proof that this is the answer. There may be something wrong with our nuclear calculations, but that's unlikely. Then there may be some cosmological reasons. Somehow maybe lithium 7 so we observe it locally. Maybe it's a local accident that we live in such a special patch of the universe or something like that. And I should say that, you can play with scale of tensor theories to make lithium 7 less and so on. And you can, as I said, play with decaying and annihilating particles to reduce lithium 7. So this story also has a long history, and people have looked at the injection of energy due to the decay of the weak scale particles, and one sort of typically has a suppression of lithium 7 due to the this decay is due to this effect of extra neutrons, but that's occurring typically in a very narrow lifetime interval around 1,000 seconds. You cannot extend it further in time because the very dramatic impact on lithium 6. I should say that if you have non-thermal particles in the game, you can have non-thermal tritium and helium-3 nuclei that bypass the usual very much suppressed chain that leads to lithium-6, and you generate lithium-6 non-thermally. So what I was saying before was more or less a known story, and what we were busy with in the last few months, we were actually looking at what happens, what changes if you have GeV scale metastable particles. So it's particles that do not have neutrons by themselves in the final state, but they produce muons and pions and so on. So my first reaction was that nothing much interesting should happen because you don't get neutrons. But that turned out to be not true, and in particular, because the pions and the kaons that can be produced in the decay actually generate a lot of neutrons, or enough neutrons to have an impact on lithium 7. So this is the scenario. So you have some unknown particle in the GeV range from a member of dark forces, so to speak, that decays to pions or kaons or muons that produces electron anti-neutrinos. And So these particles, they don't live long. They decay almost right away, but they do have some nuclear chemical impact, and that's what we were calculating. And this, so this requires a lot of details, going through details, sort of accounting for electromagnetic stopping of particles, accounting for mesonuclear and mesonhelium reactions at rest and in flight, and so on. So overall, this is a lengthy problem, and although Neil was referring to some non-traditional ways of doing theoretical physics, here you have to stick to sort of traditional way and calculate things, right? So anyways, the question that we're first thing that you should ask yourself is how many pions and cans does your BBN framework tolerate? And you can go through a very simple estimate to know what the efficiency. Suppose you inject one pion, what does it do? How many neutrons you get out of that? This is very easy calculation at a certain level of accuracy. So if you say you inject a pion at 1,000 seconds, it actually gets stopped before it decays. When it's thermalized, the pi minus has a probability of converting a proton to neutron. And so the overall probability during the pion lifetime turns out to be 10 to minus 6. So in 1 pion with a probability of 10 to minus 6 gives you a neutron. You can say, well, this is a very, very small number, but remember the number of neutrons that you need per proton is at the level of 10 to minus 5. So if you have 10 pions per proton, that's enough to actually generate a very large impact on the lithium abundance. So this is what we put carefully in the BBN code, and we have come up with this region of the parameter space where you have a factor of 3 or 4 suppression in the beryllium-7 abundance, and somewhat higher but tolerably higher abundance of deuterium. Because extra neutrons that you put in, naive thought, oh, they will decay away. No, they actually don't. The most effective thing that removes neutrons is a recombination with protons into the deuterium. And so you cannot go to a higher lifetimes because of the lithium-6 constraints. But these constraints are much weaker than in the general case where the weak scale particles are decaying. And you cannot go to a much shorter lifetimes because of the helium-4 constraints, because you do produce extra neutrons. But there is a rather wide range of abundances where you can have a satisfactory reduction of the neutron, of the lithium abundance with roughly 10 pions per nucleon. Or 10 exotic particles decaying with branchings order 1 to 2 pions. So if you look at in this modified scenario, you have a little bit of overabundance of neutrons at crucial times, and that is enough to push down the beryllium-7 line. And this is kind of interesting because the actual abundance of pions themselves is dynamical equilibrium abundance is of course very low because the lifetime is very, very short. But even during that short lifetime, they have enough power to generate an interesting number of neutrons. Completely different possibility occurs when your new particles generate a lot of muons in the final state. Then things that suppress lithium-7 and generate a lot of neutrons is electron neutrinos. They're being injected into the plasma with the temperatures of with energies on the order of some fraction of the muon mass, say 30 MeV, and that's quite a bit more energetic than neutrinos in the thermal bath, and the probability of their reaction with protons actually grows with the neutrino energy, and that's enough to generate extra neutrons that suppresses the lithium 7 abundance. Of course, the neutrino probability of producing neutron out of proton is much smaller. It's at the level of 10 to minus 9. So therefore, you need around 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 initial particles that give muons to do that. But interestingly enough, in this scenario, there are also regions of parameter space where not only you suppress lithium 7, but you don't touch, I mean, the deuterium abundance is actually exactly equal to the standard BBN prediction. And that is because not only you produce neutrons that generate deuterium, but they also produce some energy that at a later stage beats the deuterium abundance down. So we also considered the implications of all this scenario for various models that I showed. In particular, we looked at Higgs portal models where these light particles are coupled to the Higgs portal, or this Holden model that I showed before with the new U1 particle coupled through the kinetic mixing, in which case the long-lived particle is the Higgs. So I call it a WIMP regime because this is the case when these Higgs particles are initially in thermal abundance. They weigh about 1 GeV, and then an interesting process happens when they suppress their abundance, and I'll get to that in a second. The lifetime, like I said, there is a kinematic sort of accident that it's inversely proportional to the fourth power of the mixing parameters. So even if your mixing parameter is 10 to the minus 5, these particles can be long-lived at a scale of 1,000 seconds or more. And that's what makes them interesting. But if they are lightest particles of this sector and they weigh about a GeV and they're long-lived, how come that their abundance is so low? Well, this was this came up in the conversation with Neil Weiner at some point, and this happens because this is the lightest particle, but and it's accidentally long-lived. But the vectors are not long-lived, so you can have, but they're heavier in mass, so you can have a process where Stern model particles, charged leptons, scatter on these Higgs particles. Get it to the unstable particle which decays. So this process is exponentially sensitive to the mass splitting between the vector particles and the Higgses. By dialing this mass splitting, you can get almost any abundance of this long-lived particle. And so in particular, if you choose this mass of the vector to be, say, 70% larger than the mass of the Higgs. This is just talking about this extra U1 sector, right? In this energy range, you can solve the lithium problem with injection of muons. And if the Higgses are above the hadronic threshold, you need a much lower numbers of those, and you can lower the number of these Higgs particles by having them more degenerate with the vectors. So vectors 30% heavier than the Higgses would generate enough pions this way. And another interesting possibility that is not dark matter related, not necessarily dark matter related, is this super WIMP regime where imagine you have a very, very weakly coupled particles. Say suppose you have this new vector particles with the couplings, effective electromagnetic coupling on the order of, say, 10 to minus 26 or something like that, ridiculously small. So in that case, you can have a possibility where this sector is initially completely vacuous, right? There's no thermally excited vectors and so on. I can always arrange that. So there will be a process where the standard model would leak through this very small coupling and populate somewhat this sector, and it's all in principle calculable process. And then these vectors, again, due to this very, very small coupling, they live very long and then they decay. So this is like a nightmare scenario for particle physics, because there is no other way you can ever see that. So there would be nothing. Then you produce somewhat like a few particles per nucleon. They exist for three or four e-foldings of the universe, and then they decay away. And the only implication is that when they decay, they produce pions and so on, and that affects nuclear chemistry and nothing else, right? So it's just this is a slide to show you that indeed VVN, although it's very much like an old story, the VVN is indeed sometimes sensitive to the effects that no other observables are in principle sensitive to. Very good. So I'm very happy that I'm finishing right in time for lunch. And so I just was trying to tell you that something that you probably already know, that current WMAP determination of eta variance combined with a standard BBM framework overpredicts lithium by a factor of 3 to 5. Maybe this is an astrophysics effect that we don't understand. Maybe it really tells us something, right? So I was trying to take this somewhat seriously, and I was trying to make a link to these ideas of dark forces, that is the new GeV scale particles that were much speculated about in connection with the dark matter physics. And I showed that if you have such particles, if they live about 1,000 seconds, and if you have their abundance roughly equal to the number of protons and neutrons, maybe somewhat higher, their decays to pions and kaons generate enough neutrons at the time of 1,000 seconds to suppress the overall lithium abundance. And I can construct many models that would fit that. So it's really easy to arrange from the particle point of physics point of view. So I leave you with a question mark. Is lithium problem is trying to tell us something about particle physics, or this is astrophysics? I don't have any answer on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Maxime. Incidentally, I was very interested in your result, because we've recently recalculated the effects of primordial black hole evaporations on Big Bang nucleosynthesis, and they also generate these hadrons through, you know, they emit quark and gluon jets, and then the hadrons affect the nucleosynthesis.
Right. That would depend on the spectrum, right? I mean, so does it generate a lot of neutrons or nucleons?
Basically, I mean, the pions and the kaons and all the normal
stuff. Well, naively, the lighter particles, you generate more, right? I mean, so in that sense, it would fit into the story.
I think because it's light decaying particles. But the point is, we were only interested in the constraints on the number of black holes, and we hadn't thought of it as a positive way of explaining the lithium.
If you provide enough pions at the relevant temperatures of 40 kV, that's you're affecting lithium first, then deuterium first. So you know there are of course constraints, but first you you correct the discrepancy, and then there are constraints.
Okay. Thank you. So, well, we finished nice and early, so we have time for more questions. Jim.
You mentioned other experimental signatures. Can you briefly indicate?
Right. So these things that talking about, this dark forces with the kinetic mixing of 10 to the minus 5, right? So if you have a powerful enough beam of protons or electrons, it actually, you can produce this vector particles off the target. These are not the 1,000 second living Higgses from that sector, but these associated vector particles. They would decay almost right away into pairs of muons or pairs of leptons, so you'd be looking for fixed target signatures of strange peaks in the invariant masses of vectors and so on. In existing, you can use the existing fixed target facilities. Let's put it this way. You don't have to collide particle and antiparticle. You can just take a very powerful beam and smash it into the target, right? That's right. And so there are proposals currently of searching for this, in particular, this vector particles using the electron beam facilities at JLab, and I understand that it's sort of proposal may get improved, and the experiment may happen very soon. So this has been done in the 80s, but there was sort of a period of relative quietness in the 90s, and so now there is a return of the interest towards dark forces.
Okay, Ruth?
I just have a question about this extremely weakly coupled vector. Wouldn't you expect that it would be more strongly coupled very early in the universe and therefore also be there with thermal abundance, and then you would have too many of these vectors? Because you need to have very few.
That's a good question. So if you have a really extremely weakly coupled, say, axions of a GeV mass, right? Then my question is ill-posed, because if you go to the higher temperatures, the rates of production go up, and you will not predict how many of them. But these are vectors, and they interact with the charged particles, and you actually can show that their production peaks at where their mass is. So unless you would put by hand the higher dimensional operators that will increase their production at high temperatures. If this renormalizable level, that's all there is to it, then the production peaks at the mass. So if they're a GeV scale, it's a QCD scale, QCD epoch where it peaks.
Okay. Well, if there are no more questions, we'll close the session now. Thank you, Maxime. But I have one important announcement. There's a long lunch break. It goes on till 3:30. But